Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Competing rallies are occurring in the U.S. city of Boston, Massachusetts, in response to last week's violent protests in the city of Charlottesville, Virginia. This is where a group of white nationalists gathered to protest the removal of a Confederate statue. One person was killed during the event, and two police officers on their way to the event died when their helicopter crashed. VOA's Carolyn Persuti is in Boston and tells us that police are asking for calm, but are prepared for the worst.
They'll walk about 3 kilometers to the Boston Common, where the other side is holding their rally. And that is where people are concerned that clashes will occur. Everyone here has told me they are here to stand for inclusion. They are here to stand for tolerance. They are chanting against Nazis. They are chanting against people who discriminate, and they are for people of color. We will have all the updates for you as they unfold here in Boston. But for now, I'm Carolyn Persuti, VOA News.
The news that White House Chief Strategist Steve Bannon was leaving the Trump administration was made public Friday afternoon. By evening, he was back at work at his old job. Bannon left the White House and went directly to the Breitbart News Network, the ultra-conservative online publication he led before joining the Trump administration and the presidential campaign a little more than a year ago. Bannon is credited with helping Mr. Trump win the White House. This was by pushing a populist, nationalist message after joining the campaign. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Catalan police have arrested a fourth man in connection with 2 terrorist attacks in the Barcelona region of Spain that left many dead and dozens more injured. VOA's Philip Alexio has more.
One more death was added to the list Friday, bringing the deadly total to 14. Police said suspects in Spain's deadly twin terror attacks were preparing an even bigger assault that was foiled as events unfolded. Police said they killed 5 suspected terrorists during the night and arrested 3 others as Spain reeled from the double tragedy in Barcelona and in Cambrils, some 120 kilometers south. Philip Alexio, VOA News.
The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for that deadly attack on the van and pedestrians in Barcelona. U.S. President Donald Trump met Friday with his national security team to discuss a new strategy to deal with the 16-year-old war in Afghanistan. VOA's Ira Melman reports.
After a day spent huddling with his top advisors and military leaders in his mountain retreat, President Trump used his Twitter feed to say, "Important day spent at Camp David with our very talented generals and military leaders, many decisions made, including on Afghanistan." He gave no further details, but he has expressed dissatisfaction with recent Taliban advances in the fighting there.
"We're getting very close, sir. It's a very big decision for me. I took over a mess, and we're going to make it a lot less messy."
The U.S. Defense Department approved a plan months ago to send about 3,800 additional troops to assist the Afghan army, but some White House officials questioned whether more resources would be effective. Ira Melman, VOA News.
Police in Finland say a stabbing spree left 2 people dead and at least 6 others injured in the southwestern coastal city of Turku. And it's being investigated as a terrorist attack. The suspect, whom the police shot in the leg, was identified as an 18-year-old Moroccan citizen. Security has been heightened at Helsinki Airport and at train stations in response to the stabbings. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is returning to Nigeria. His spokesman said Saturday, following extended stay in London to treat an undisclosed illness. He's been away since May 7th, and some Nigerians were beginning to demand Buhari return to work or step down from office. Buhari first left Nigeria in January to receive treatment in Britain, staying nearly 2 months before returning in March, only to leave again in May. During both absences, Buhari temporarily passed executive power to his vice president. More at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Well, we thank God for this moment Nigerians have voted for. The president is well enough to come back and to resume work. So he's flying in as I speak to you now.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari finally returns home Saturday after over 100 days abroad for medical treatment.
There is anger, there is disappointment, and there is so much desire to see justice. I've never really felt this palpable desire to see justice prevail even in a country that is just across the border.
The Southern African government considers granting diplomatic immunity to Zimbabwean First Lady Grace Mugabe.
It basically started to take more precautions about how to deliver some of its work and how to deliver humanitarian, particularly humanitarian assistance, because humanitarian assistance comes to the people who are most in need.
And the United Nations commemorates World Humanitarian Day Saturday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is returning home following an extended stay in London for medical treatment for an undisclosed illness. He has been away since May 7, and some Nigerians say Buhari should return to work or step down from office. The president first left Nigeria in January to receive treatment in Britain, staying nearly 2 months before returning in March, only to leave again in early May. During both absences, Buhari temporarily passed executive power to his vice president, Yemi Osinbajo, as President Buhari was on his way to Nigeria. I spoke with presidential spokesman Garba Shehu to learn more.
Well, we thank God for this moment Nigerians have voted for. The president is well enough to come back and to resume work. So he's flying in as I speak to you now.
What is the mood in the country at the moment?
It's one of the relief and excitement, because Nigerians have looked forward to this moment, hoping and praying that the president finishes his treatment and returns home. So yes, here we are today. And I believe that Nigerians would have a lot of joy that they would derive from this arrival of the president.
I hear the president will be addressing the nation early next week. What can you tell me about this?
Well, it's, I believe, a presidential address, and we will expect anything. The president has had time out and is now back. And he must be free. You know, appreciative of Nigerians for their patience and for the prayers that they have done to God for his early recovery and all of that. So I believe that we would expect an important speech on Monday from the president.
Some people are saying the president should have rested a little bit instead of going straight back to work and addressing the nation. You don't think those concerns are justified?
Well, opinions are bound to differ. Some people had been saying that he should have been speaking yesterday. So therefore, yes, people are entitled to their opinions on this. But the decision is made, the president will speak on Monday. In my view, I think that is early enough.
So as he returns, he officially assumes his duty and the vice president goes back to his vice presidential duties per the constitution.
I'm not in a position to say that until the president comes back and the pronouncement is officially made.
So what message do you have for the people of Nigeria as the president arrives in a short moment?
We have nothing to say but thank you, Nigerians, because Nigerians have been very patient. The Constitution has made it possible for a president to take this kind of absence from office, hand over power to his deputy, and be away for as long as he wants. The Constitution is fair to leaders. But the Constitution has also been fair to Nigerians by requesting that the power be handed over to the vice president. And this is what we witnessed. The president followed the Constitution, and the right thing has been done throughout this period.
Garba Shehu is a spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The Sierra Leonean National Disaster Management Team met Friday to assess the situation following the flood and mudslide which left over 400 people dead and many more displaced from their homes. The disaster began when heavy rains hit the capital, Freetown, and the partial collapse of a hillside triggered mudslides, engulfing homes and wrecking destruction. Many citizens have questioned why the government has not done more to tackle illegal construction and deforestation on the outskirts of the overcrowded capital. Abdoulaye Berete, spokesman for President Enes Bai Koroma, told me the government is calling for international assistance as the country grapples with the aftermath of the mudslide and flooding.
When we met as a group at the Office of National Security, which is the body mandated to coordinate this activity, we are able to brief ourselves on the way forward and also to report on our interventions in the affected communities. For instance, in the recovery area, the military is still leading the process there. Bodies are still being recovered, though on a small scale. And of course, the challenges we are also identified. And we also are expecting some decisive interventions on the part of the international community, because we'll be having forensic experts to come and help us with this tragedy. And also, the World Bank has dispatched a team to come and do a real risk assessment for us. So this is where we are.
Every year, Sierra Leoneans express concern that during the rainy season, there's flooding. Why hasn't the government implemented infrastructural program to help alleviate such perennial problem?
We have done our best as a government. We have tried to clear the drainages. We have engaged communities that let them don't clog the gutters by putting garbage in there with a trickle of rain. All of this we have done as a country. But so far, we are still having what happened for us in this country is nothing but a natural disaster of some disproportionate magnitude. And this is where we believe we'll continue to remind ourselves that moving forward, the government will have to take the stick approach so that all the disaster-prone areas will be removed. We remove the residents there and relocate them. And this is where we continue to appeal to the international community for support so that we'll be able to undertake that initiative. For us, it is like we want the support now rather than later.
What are the lessons learned?
Well, over the years, with all the deforestation that is happening in this country, with all human interference with nature, the government has mostly been going with a carrot approach. But I think it has come to the point whereby the sympathy and sensitization, it is now for decisive action. And I am repeating exactly what President Koroma said today in the cabinet meeting there, that this is a time for us as a country. Whilst we have engaged communities, reminding them on the dangers, whilst we have dispatched the environmental protection agencies into communities and they were chased out of those communities, pelted with stones. And years back, we even had an official killed in one of the areas when he went to demarcate the protected area. That's notwithstanding though. I think it is time for us as a people, not necessarily as a government. The government is going to provide the leadership, but the people must also understand that whatever harsh measures the government is going to take will be in the interest of everybody, so that we cannot be sorry at the end of it all.
Abdoulaye Berete is the spokesman for the Sierra Leonean President Enes Bai Koroma. He spoke with me from Freetown. The South African government is considering granting diplomatic immunity to Zimbabwean First Lady Grace Mugabe. The move will allow the controversial Zimbabwean First Lady to avoid prosecution for the alleged assault of a 20-year-old model, Gabriella Engels. Engels accuses Mrs. Mugabe of beating her with an electric extension cable in a Johannesburg house. She also claimed to have received cuts and bruises. For a reaction back home, I read Rejoice Ngwenya, a political analyst in the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Total outrage. There is anger, there is disappointment, and there is so much desire to see justice. I've never really felt this palpable desire to see justice prevail even in a country that is just across the border.
Well, I understand a lot of opposition supporters would want South Africa to prosecute her for such violence in their country. However, it looks unlikely since she was granted international immunity.
It's probably, Peter, expecting too much because we are talking about a woman who is married to a person who is associated with so much political violence in the past 30 years. So it is probably asking for too much for us Zimbabweans to expect anything to happen to Grace, because we know that ZANU-PF and ANC, particularly Jacob Zuma, they have got a very close umbilical tie. It will be a miracle if there is any justice that prevails on Grace Mugabe.
Some Zimbabweans I spoke with said the violence allegedly exhibited by the First Lady is an extension of violence perpetrated by supporters of ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe. Do you share that assessment?
Absolutely. I mean, a few months ago, it was Grace herself addressing ZANU-PF youth, swearing that it was not the right thing to be involved in violence. But the nature of violence in ZANU-PF is within their DNA. It doesn't matter how much extreme provocation that Grace has experienced from Gabrielle Angel, but it was not necessarily a mother instinctively should protect the children, and her form of discipline is unacceptable. So I would really agree that it just shows the nature of people that are within that party, and violence really, it's something that is inbuilt within their way of solving problems.
Do you expect any diplomatic relations to be hampered following this incident, or you think relationship between Harare and Pretoria will remain the same, irrespective of the violence allegedly committed by Grace Mugabe?
Look, I've been tracking a lot of legal opinion. Alex Magaisa, Papka, Petina Gapa, Gabriel Schumba from South Africa, and I have a strong feeling that the South African government and the Zimbabwean government will find their way of winning out of this crisis. And I really am convinced that this is not going to cause a single element of diplomatic negativity between the two countries. If anything, I can sense some kind of diabolic solidarity between these two governments.
Some Zimbabweans are demanding that when Grace Mugabe, your First Lady, returns to Zimbabwe, she has to render an unqualified apology for tarnishing the image of the country in neighboring South Africa. Do you foresee that happening?
Well, I don't really foresee that happening because, Grace Mugabe really reminds me of Winnie Mandela. If we're talking about a family of decent individuals here within the Mugabe family, I would really see Mugabe filing for divorce from someone. But as I said, Peter, there is always this sense of solidarity that engulfed ZANU-PF. And I can even see the state media trying to justify her actions and claiming that she was provoked, or the lady who was involved in some drug deal. But Grace Mugabe is not drug enforcement of South Africa. So it doesn't matter what it is, but Zimbabweans have a right to demand that Grace apologizes to us for dragging our name into this mess.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. The Malawian Broadcasting Corporation, a state broadcaster, has decided to play only local music on its networks on Fridays. The decision came after Parliament passed an act which requires all local broadcasting stations to play 70% of local music and 30% foreign music. Local artists welcomed the development and called on each other to step up efforts to produce quality music. They also called on other state media groups to emulate the example of the state broadcaster. Chempenzi Mhoni, spokesperson for the Malawian Broadcasting Corporation, told me the decision aims to give space to Malawian artists to showcase their skills more than ever before.
What we have decided is to play only Malawian music on Fridays on all our platforms. And this is basically complementing government's efforts of promoting Malawian products. Last year, government gave a directive to all public service staff to wear Malawian clothing on Fridays. So as Malawi Broadcasting Corporation and as a public service broadcaster, we took that directive as well. But as a way of complementing that, basically this initiative is just to complement government's efforts in promoting the Malawian culture, as it were.
Recently, the Malawi National Assembly passed an act requiring all local broadcasting houses to play 70% of local music and 30% foreign music. Do you think you have that amount of quality airplay to achieve that 70% that the act requires?
As a country, we do have a number of local artists, and there's a lot of local content that is being produced. Yeah, there is enough allowing music to be played to reach the 70%.
Some Malawians I spoke with are concerned that with this provision in the act, it could cut both ways. It could make Malawian musicians to be complacent and not produce quality work.
I think every musician or any artist, the moment they get into their trade, they have a vision, or they get in their trade with an aim of getting something out of it. And they know how competitive the world is. And what we ought to understand and what we need to put right out here, there is competition out there. In as much as we have local content producers, we are competing. We are living in a global world. I think local artists cannot be complacent and just sit there and say, just because there is that particular act, and then they can just produce low quality type of music. I don't think that would be the case, because then they would be killing their own market.
How will MBC ensure that the music produced in Malawi will meet its standard? And two, will there be an issue where if local music is produced, directors of the MBC will find it objectionable and could possibly ban it?
When it comes to, I'll go back to our mandate as a public broadcaster. Any type of music that we play on our channels, we make sure that it is in the interest of the public. So at the end of the day, in as much as, because our mandate is to educate, inform and entertain, so we ensure that the content in the music that we get meets those values of educating, entertaining and informing. We would not in any way put anything that could be probably that could compromise public peace or anything in that line. And in terms of quality, we always ensure that everything that is played on radio is of good. I'm not sure if you're looking at the technical aspect of it or in terms of the way the music is mixed, but everything that we play on our channels, we make sure that it is something that at least meets that quality level standard, where it can also be appreciated with or on an international level.
Have you heard any reaction from the Malawi Union of Musicians or MUM?
As of now, we haven't gotten, because it's only barely, not more than 4 weeks since we started it. But then we are open to feedback from MUM or from even the general public, because feedback is important. Feedback is what is going to help us get better in our content delivery. So we have all our platforms open. Our website is open. People can contact us through there. So we are welcome to get any sort of feedback.
Chembezi Mhoni is the spokesperson for the Malawian Broadcasting Corporation. She spoke with me from the commercial capital, Blantyre. As it commemorates World Humanitarian Day, the United Nations is calling for a stop to the deliberate targeting of civilians and humanitarians who risk their lives to assist the many desperate men, women and children caught in war. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
August 19th is the day when the United Nations lost its innocence. On that day in 2003, the United Nations office in Iran's capital, Baghdad, was bombed, killing the head of mission, Sergio Vieira de Mello, and 21 others. Mona Rishmawi, who was working as de Mello's human rights agenda advisor, survived the terrorist attack because she was late for a meeting called by Sergio. She tells VOA the fatal explosion explosion, which destroyed the Canal Hotel, taking the lives of 22 people and injuring many more, was a turning point in the United Nations mission. She says the UN shut down its open communication with the people it was serving and became more protective.
Well, and it was the first time we realized that, no, we could be targeted for something very, very serious. So I think it basically started to take more precautions about how to deliver some of its work and how to deliver humanitarian, particularly humanitarian assistance, because humanitarian assistance comes to the people who are most in need.
5 years after this tragic event, the General Assembly adopted a resolution designating August 19th World Humanitarian Day to pay tribute to aid workers who risk their lives in the service of others. To mark this year's observance, the UN is focusing on violence against healthcare workers and facilities and its implications for the population. The United Nations reports there were 302 attacks, including 418 deaths last year. Most occurred in Syria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Agricultural officials from the South Sudanese Imatong state say insecurity is hampering aid agencies from helping farmers produce food to end persistent shortages. Government and UN Food and Agriculture Organization say violence prevents farmers from venturing onto their village farms to harvest grains and vegetables that would normally feed their families and provide surplus food to sell in the market. For VOA, Tito Jesting recently visited Torit and has this report from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
Dozens of members of a Torit farmers group sing about the daily hardships they face from chronic food shortages while FAO and CAN international officials distributed seeds of new crop varieties to farmers. Robert Lokang Peter heads the local farmers group called Bedaya, which is being supported by the FAO. He says farmers who fled their village during fighting between government and rebel forces have left behind large tracts of farmable land that used to produce food for Torit residents.
The next challenge is insecurity now, because we have 10 acres behind us here. We have that 10 acres, but we cannot reach. That we abandon that land. We would have even to be that site. It could be better than this.
Officials confirm many farmers left the rural areas and moved to Torit town to escape insecurity in recent months. Farmers say they are afraid to return to their farms about 10 kilometers from Torit town because others have been harassed by armed groups along the way. Farmer Mary Peter fled her Yari village due to fighting. Speaking Arabic, she says she now lives in Torit and farms a small piece of land.
I moved away from that area because it's insecure. That land is not accessible to us at the moment because there are armed groups, and it's not good to continue to live there.
Although Peter would like to cultivate more crops, she does not have the land to do so. Both FAO and CARE International help support displaced farmers like Peter by giving them seeds and tools to produce vegetables, including tomatoes, eggplants, and cabbages, which they sell in the market to earn a living. Johnson Kenyi Simon, the state director of agriculture, says government soldiers often prevent farmers from accessing rural areas because they think it is not safe for civilians to venture out. He says they are also suspicious.
When you go out, you become a problem to them. They say, why did you go out there? If you have a farm like this one in Egypt, where we are cultivating, you go beyond there, they will be patient. Have you gone to them now? Then you will be complicated that we are taking messages to those guys.
Alfred Gwarit, a FAO agriculture officer in Torit, says the violence in rural areas makes it dangerous for farmers to earn a living and feed their families.
At the moment, people are only confined to their own homesteads with a small kitchen garden around. That's why you find them just cultivating around the household, because they can't go far. If they go far, they are fearing insecurity. Anything can happen in terms of those who are outside attacking people.
Torit resident like Mary Joseph says the food security situation in Torit continues to deteriorate. Speaking Arabic, Joseph says many roads that farmers and traders normally use have become too dangerous to travel.
Food used to come from Yeri about 15 kilometers from Torit town, but after the conflict, Yeri road was forced to close. Our situation is bad.
Joseph says if the road to Uganda opens, They will have access to vegetables, but only if they can afford to buy them. Famine was declared in parts of South Sudan earlier this year. The FAO warned that unless South Sudan's leaders end the conflict, it will be nearly impossible to improve the food security situation in the country. The FAO also said more than 4 million South Sudanese are food insecure, and many women and children are at risk of starving. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
kula ya kagombe. Anti kuno mukwano echi womereza chisukako kuba mukwano kuno kwa tabu wonkonta jogera chimulavu lavu. Bola vinta bola oya galanza tule. Okay, ya sala wono mutima gunda nenzikiriza nebyange byonna kugabira mukwano gunda eno lavu yange ya tap ne wate okuchuse chuse kuteke teke. Chogera juli tunula mu maso gange eno labu yangeri ya tabu omenya menye nyingo laba yompunze nzinda kakopono lire amakula gali mu labu bitomo tapta abono la labu nasala wono omutima gwonna nenzikiriza nebyange byonna kugabira omukwano gwonna eno labu yangeri ya tabu ne wate yoku chuse chuse kuteke teke mubya labu kupule pule bitomu tapta avunula labu zekuite malaba.
Chino tu chingale, yira tu chingale, we. Yira tu chingale, chino tu chingale, yira tu chingale, we. Lava what to say, ngatema mika kulose, makulama utuna wanawani mama, mumu kwa na mujena, mitia wa mikyo watende ime yangu wano, uje mandenga siyana, lelo ntelenge.
Don't you worry, cause time's a wendi,
nange wendi, nze uo. Yira tu tuchingale chino tuchingale ira tuchingale we Omugongo wange mukaluba tonkole bekitini Yeah we jangu jangwe no mati kukwateko Motomate mande fanze piroso Motu sati nabo bulamu mwewe jaga Telo tuke kubana linda
Show me the way how to live better, to live better.
Sawa.
Afrika yetu
sawa.
ndiye wetu sawa watu ni watu sawa na sisi ni watu sawa rachisi maneno betu sawa kufuo mulele tu sawa wange omulele tu sawa bila bantu bange sawa unono mulele tu sawa chogerani na betu sawa they want it sawa
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, producer Jackson Mvonganyi, our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a large eye does not mean keen vision. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Famine Early Warning Systems Network, or FuseNet, a U.S. government-funded provider of information and analysis on food insecurity, is signaling that the hunger and nutrition situation in southeastern Ethiopia is deteriorating, with numerous households in the drought-ridden Somali regional state already experiencing severe food insecurity. Likewise in Kenya, although the situation is not as dire, insufficient March to May rainfall has left people living in the country's arid and semi-arid regions at risk of crisis-level food insecurity in the near future. In 2011, the Horn of Africa suffered one of the worst droughts on record. The next few years saw subpar rainfall, which means that the hardest-hit regions did not have the chance to recover, either for growing grain or replenishing pasturage. Then came the 2015-2016 season and the abnormally warm El Niño phase of the global weather pattern. As a result, the most fragile regions in the arid Horn of Africa once again saw the deterioration of agricultural and livestock production, rising food prices, and a future wrought with hunger, malnutrition, and resulting diseases. Today, 7.8 million Ethiopians are suffering acute food insecurity, as are 2.6 million Kenyans. That is why the United States announced in early August that it will deliver more than $169 million worth of humanitarian aid for Ethiopia and Kenya. In doing so, the United States is scaling up emergency food assistance. The funds will provide such necessities as specialized nutrition supplies to treat malnourished children, safe drinking water, and essential health services. In Ethiopia, this assistance will provide food aid for about 3 million people. In addition to aid for Kenyans affected by the drought, the United States is also providing support for refugees in Kenya who have fled drought and conflict in their own countries. It is not a famine, but it is rising up to the levels of getting close to famine, said Matt Nims, acting director of Food for Peace at the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. That is why we want to act now, so that we're not into that stage.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.